come on a journey with a cinephile.
Wake up, sucker. We're thieves and we're bad guys. That's exactly what we are.
We was getting too big for our bitches.
Excellent day for an exorcism.
What have you done to its eyes?
I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains in.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Biddy well, little brother. Biddy well.
Hello and welcome, listeners, to episode 114 of Journey with a Cinephile, a horror movie podcast. As always, I'm your tour guide here of David Garrett Jr., recording out of Columbus, Ohio. And on this episode here for you is going to be my new year, new movie number 7. As this is one of those things where, if you don't know, I take all these movies that I've heard about through podcasts or just other venues, I have them numbered, and then I use a randomizer to figure out what I'm going to watch. And when I did that, the movie that popped up is from 2019 of Dark Encounter. And then the double feature here is just going to be two that I've never seen before, as I did end up figuring out late in the week that there was a 2022 film that was released of Monsters in the Closet. This is a low-budget anthology film. So those are going to be the two featured reviews here on this episode. And then I also have mini-reviews of Hoxin. This is the one from 1922 as I continue my trek through the twos. I also have I Am Not a Serial Killer, The Eyes of My Mother, the Suspiria remake from 2018. And then the last mini-review I'll have for you here is going to be The Scary of 61st. Don't really think there's anything else I need to get you up to speed with here for this, so let me go ahead and get you over to a brief break before I get into those mini reviews, and I hope you enjoy coming on this journey with me.
Journey with a Cinephile.
And for my first mini review on this episode is going to be Hoxin. This is from 1922. This is written and directed by Benjamin Christensen, who also stars in this, along with Elizabeth Christensen and Maren Peterson. This is a documentary fantasy history horror film that is a co-production between Sweden and Denmark. This is currently sitting on a 7.7 on IMDb and a 3.9 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being a fictionalized documentary showing the evolution of witchcraft from its pagan roots to its confusion with hysteria in Eastern Europe. So this is a film that I got turned on to while listening to horror movie podcasts. The title came up a few times and it was intriguing. As someone who took history of cinema classes in college, I didn't hear about this one there, but when I started learning the history of the genre that I love, it, you know, kind of turned me on to it, and it was on a list that I wanted to see, you know, for a little bit there. So prior to my first viewing, I did some research to seeing this and learned that it was quite innovative with some of the things that they showed and was actually a bit racy as well for the time. So I'm also watching this one as my trek through the twos, as I was knocking out another one, you know, as well as making this part of my Centennial Club. So, in a nutshell, what we are getting here is mostly a documentary and then reenactments of the information that are laying out. I do think there's a lot of good information here. There's also quite a bit of creepy imagery as well. The first thing I really wanted to delve into with my analysis was that I thought writer, director, and even star Christensen did a great job at laying out the information. I love the old drawings that are used, and his breakdown of them makes a lot of sense. I could tell there was a lot of research done, and I appreciate it. I also like that during the first few reenactments, he is pointing out the lunacy of the Inquisitions and how none of these people were probably witches. During the pagan times, I bet there were. It was a bit more primitive time, though, and the movie seems to be pointing out that through the methods used, innocent people were tortured into admitting things, and their tests were quite fallible. I find this to be interesting as there are modern day applications here that fit for the current situations. I mean, we hear the word witch hunt in the lexicon of news regularly. Going along with this, we see that despite more education and knowledge, we still handle situations with a more modern take on what happened in the Middle Ages as well. So an issue that I did have that came up in the final chapter of this one, where things looked at, considered to be modern, becomes an issue. I do believe and agree at times that there was a witch was someone suffering from mental illness. The film flips its stance a bit, though, and sides with religion at least to an extent. If they would have kept their course with looking at things scientifically, I think I would have been on board the whole way. Regardless of my beliefs or what the movie is stating, it does make some valid points for sure. Then the shift is over to the pacing. Both times that I've seen this, I've watched the 105 minutes in length version. I originally thought this movie runs a bit too long. That's not necessarily the case anymore. I can see that it does get a bit repetitive, though. Now, there is a shorter version that I've read that runs about 30 minutes or so shorter, and I believe it's on the Criterion Blu-ray that I have. I would like to see how that one flows and what was left out. Other than that, I think this is edited in a way that's quite interesting. I like the progression that we get through the information that is presented. Now, since it's a silent film, the acting can be difficult to talk about sometimes. They are normally stage actors or people with little or no acting experience, as this is early into history of cinema. There tends to be overacting, as they must be since they can't convey through speech. With that said, I think that the acting is good across the board. Shout out to Christensen as he portrays the devil. He did a good job at being creepy and trying to corrupt those around him. The rest of the cast I thought was fine for the roles and how they play it. It is interesting to see that they're accusing each other of being witches. Seeing what they've endured during the Inquisition did bother me. It does work overall for sure. To then take this to the effects, I was quite impressed, to be honest. The look of the devil I thought was good, along with the other nightmarish creatures. And I'm not going to lie, I was creeped out watching this. They also do some early stop motion with a smaller creature that was spooky. We get some tricks of film to show, like witches flying on brooms and souls leaving the body. There was a special feature showing how some of this was done, which I thought was also kind of cool to see. This is done better than some things that are shown well after this, if I'm going to be honest. This movie is shot very basic, but that goes back to early cinema. This is a documentary of sorts, and it adds a layer with that. So last thing I'll go over would be the soundtrack. Now, I don't know the version that I watched had the original score that was coupled with it or not. I was kind of glancing over that Blu-ray, and it does seem like it was, and it made me feel uneasy. It fit perfectly with what they're going for and raised attention for the scenes. It is interesting, though, since this really doesn't play the same way a film would work today, but for the reenactments, it really did make it feel scarier than it probably should have, and I'm going to be perfectly honest with that. So with that said, I'm glad that I finally got around to seeing this and now giving it a second watch. It does a lot of good things, and I like the approach of being a documentary film. We get the actual drawings from the past and bringing the concepts to life with reenactments. I like the elements there being part of this. The acting is over the top, which you come to expect from silent era films. The Christensen, though, does a good devil. If I'm going to be honest, I thought the effects were state-of-the-art for the period. You can tell that it was, you know, shot from this era just from how everything looks. I'm not sure if the soundtrack coupled with it is the intended one. I have, you know, since confirmed that. But I think they did a good job with how eerie it was. I will warn you that this is from the 1920s and in black and white. That's an issue. I'd avoid this. If this sounds interesting and you like the history of cinema as well as the horror genre, I'd give this one a go. So my rating here for Hoxton is an 8.5 out of 10. And for my next mini review, I have I Am Not a Serial Killer. This is from 2016. This was directed by Billy O'Brien, who also co-wrote this with Christopher Hyde, and this came from the novel from Dan Wells. This stars Max Records, Christopher Lloyd, and Laura Fraser. This is a drama horror thriller film that is a co-production between Ireland, United Kingdom, and the United States. It is currently sitting on a 6.3 on IMDb and a 3.2 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis here being: in a small Midwestern town, a troubled teen with homicidal tendencies must hunt down and destroy a supernatural killer while keeping his own inner demons at bay. So it's a movie that I learned about through podcasts. It went on a list of movies to see, and this was one that I made part of my 31 Days of Halloween one year. I enjoyed it, but it was a movie that I forgot about pretty quickly after it, to be honest. I am now giving this a rewatch as part of the summer series for the podcast Under the Stairs, as this was on the 2016 list over there. So This is one that I also figured out from podcasts that it was based on a series of novels. And after seeing this, I'm interested in seeing what they're about and how they're different from this movie. So with my first viewing, I originally thought this was going to be more of a mystery where this kid might be murdering people and not realizing it. But it's much different than that. John, who's our main character, has the factors that would make him a killer, but he's not actually killed anyone and has learned mechanisms to control his urges. This might be a slight spoiler, but it's right there in this first 30 minutes or so of who the killer is. I personally wish that this would have been something in the mind of John, so I wasn't the biggest fan of where it goes. I will say that this is still interesting regardless, as we almost have a young Dexter-type killer who might be, you know, trying to keep control of himself, or he could end up being a serial killer, as title states. Before going into other aspects, I want to delve into the character of John just a little bit more here. I thought that Record's performance as John Wayne Cleaver is solid. When I started to write this, I told Jamie that I thought his name was being cheeky. I still think it is, since there is a serial killer, of course, of John Wayne Gacy. Now, when seeing that his sister's name in the credits is Lauren Bacall Cleaver, his parents just seem to love old cinema, so John is supposed to be a sociopath here. I think for the most part, he plays this well. There is a bit near the end where I don't know if it necessarily fits into what they've been establishing, but overall, I'd say that his performance is solid. So then moving from there, it wasn't surprising to me who the killer was and the creature that it is. The synopsis gives this away. So originally, I was wondering if we were seeing was real or not. I was even questioning it again during this viewing. I think it could have been done without having what we get in the movie. I do recognize this is probably coming from the novel, so it is ingrained in the story itself. So it is hard to hold it against this movie if it's, you know, adapting this. So that should be enough for the story, so let me take this over to the acting. I thought it was good. I've already said what I can about Records. I also was great to see Lloyd taking on this role that he does. And to see how old of an actor this guy is and he's still acting and everything like that. So it does fit the character that he's taken on. I liked Frazier, as I thought she was good as his concerned mother. I also didn't mind Baldwin or the rest of the supporting cast. They all are playing their roles very well. An issue I did want to bring up is I think the movie introduces some things with, like, Brooke, who being interested in John like she is, but it never goes anywhere. Since this is a series of novels, I'm wondering if this was going to continue the story and, you know, just setting the stage for the next type of things. Where we sit, it doesn't add too much because it doesn't look like they were going to have any more movies, you know, following this one. So I next want to talk about the effects. They are good for the most part. A lot of them are shown at a distance, which I think is a solid choice because they are CGI. There is a point near the ending that is close, and I wasn't a huge fan of what they decided to do there. It doesn't look horrible, but it was a twist, again, that I didn't necessarily like. The ending of this film I thought was good. This one never seemed to, you know, drag to me, and the tension builds until the climax. I also thought the score of this was fine, and it doesn't necessarily stand out completely, but I know it does help some of the scenes to help set that mood, and the cinematography is also pretty solid on top of that. So with that said, I would recommend giving this a viewing. It is an interesting main character of John, and seeing what he is dealing with was good to me. There are some interesting ideas explored. I will be honest, though, I didn't care for the ending. The acting does carry this, though, especially since Records was solid and Lloyd was great. I thought the use of CGI was good for the most part, except for the reveal at the end. The editing of this film does help to build the necessary tension, and the score was solid as well. So I feel that this movie is above average, and it has come up since my previous viewing as well. This one is pretty tame, so I would recommend this to horror or non-horror fans alike. If you are into true crime, this is just kind of an interesting little story here to watch play out. So my rating here for I Am Not a Serial Killer is going to be a 7 out of 10. And then the next mini review that I have for you is going to be The Eyes of My Mother. This is from 2016. This is written and directed by Nicholas Pesch. This stars Kiki Magahalas, Will Brill, and Olivia Bond. This is a drama horror thriller film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 6.2 on IMDb and a 3.4 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis here being a young, lonely woman is consumed by her deepest and darkest desires after tragedy strikes her quiet country life. So this is a film that I heard about through podcasts that I listened to. I saw the writer-director of Pesch's next film after this one before checking this one out, so I was intrigued to see what this one had to offer, as I did enjoy that movie, and I'm now giving it a second viewing as part of the summer series for the podcast Under the Stairs, as this came up on the 2016 list. So there aren't a lot of parts to this movie. There are a few things that carry this, and the first is the location. This is quite interesting, as I grew up in the country, and it can be eerily quiet, so things that happen in this film could, without anyone knowing. Going even farther, I feel like the world has moved on, while our main character, Francesca, has kind of stayed the same. The house she's living in isn't modern, and their vehicle isn't either, and we don't really know when this is taking place, which adds to the somewhat surreal feeling as it's timeless. Now, something else this film has is good writing. What gets established early on is referenced back to later, and I'm a big fan when that is done, because I get sucked in by stories, so I like to know when I'm paying attention to all these little details that they actually have a payoff when they come back. So with that saying, I wonder if this little girl is really the daughter of this elderly couple that we see in the beginning, and that is Francesca that I'm referring to. They seem quite a bit older than normal parents' age, which makes me wonder. It's not out of the realm of possibilities, though, but also something that happens in this movie as well. Going from this, they don't call the police, which would explain why as well. Now, they do some things that normal people wouldn't, and they're committing crimes to cover up things as well. So going along with this, I feel like there is a growing sense of dread that I dug. The movie is a slow burn, which is quite interesting since it has less than an 80-minute runtime. The dread that grows as you see the life that Francesca is living, what she learns as a child, and that her parents taught her, making her into who she is. When you see what she does to Charlie and to others, it's not only sad, but quite horrific. What also drives this is the acting. I must give credit to Magahalas, as she has to play a character that is completely devoid of normal human emotions. A lot of this is the isolation that she grew up in. I can't say that she's insane because, to be honest, I don't know if she knows right from wrong. Now, Agostini is interesting in her small role as the mother who tries to teach her daughter things. Nozick is cold towards Francesca, and some of the things he teaches her take on a different route for where she ends up. Credit also to Brill and the horrific act he commits to create some of the issues here as well. I thought the rest of the characters rounded this out for what was needed. So onto the effects, which seem to be practical, and I was there for that. There aren't a lot to be used, to be honest, but the blood we get does look good. I should also point out that this is filmed in black and white, and this adds an interesting stylistic choice that I dug. With her living where she does, I think it adds to that for sure. There is this reveal of what happens to someone that made me go numb with the realism of what was done. I should end this here saying that this is shot beautifully as well. So the soundtrack is also interesting. There is a song playing in the first scene that caught my roommate's attention, as the song is about a family that was murdered by their father. There are also some old movies that are being played where we get to hear some dialogue. I bring this up as I know they are strategically put in because it goes along with what has happened in the movie. Something else that caught my attention is, with a second viewing, is that despite all of the years going back, she is watching the same movies, which helps with this timeless feel as well as she hasn't moved on. I would say the use of sound and music were solid as well. Now to wrap this up, I would say that I enjoyed this movie. I will admit the story is lacking a bit. It is quite basic, but for a movie like this, it didn't need to be more complex. The acting and the pacing drives it. It built tension in a slower way, but I thought the payoff was good. The effects we got are also solid, and the film was shot beautifully. The soundtrack was good, and not only with the music, but with dialogue from other films as well. I do think there are some minor issues, but I really liked it and would recommend giving this a viewing, as I thought it was good. I will warn you that this is a bleak one, so keep that in mind before coming in, but my rating here for The Eyes of My Mother is going to be an 8 out of 10. And then up next for you, I have Suspiria. This is the remake from 2018. This was directed by Luca Guadagnino. And then this comes from the characters from Dario Argento and Daria Nicolodi. And then the screenplay was written by David Kajdanich. This stars Chloe Grace Moretz, Tilda Swinton, and Dakota Johnson. This is a drama, fantasy, horror, mystery, thriller film that is a co-production between Italy and the United States. It is currently sitting on a 6.7 on IMDb and a 3.7 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being a darkness swirls at the center of a world-renowned dance company, one that will engulf the artistic director, an ambitious young dancer, and a grieving psychotherapist. Some will succumb to the nightmare, others will finally wake up. So this is a film that I was intrigued to check out. The original Suspiria is one of my favorite horror films of all time. I thought it was interesting when I saw this version was going to run 2.5 hours, as the original was just over an hour and a half. My first viewing was at the Gateway Film Center when they had a limited run for this one, and that was with an ex-girlfriend. I have now given it a second viewing as part of the summer series for the podcast Under the Stairs and my now wife, Jamie. So, I love the original film, as I said, even though the story might be lacking a bit. Something I've explained to Jamie is that Italian cinema uses a lot of nightmare logic. They don't necessarily feel the need to clarify everything. So when I first saw that this one had an extra hour of runtime, I was intrigued as they could flesh out more of the story, which they did. Originally, I had an issue with the power struggle that's in this movie. This time around, I think it adds another layer. Now, I'm going to tiptoe around this as I don't want to spoil anything here, but we have Helena Marcos, who is in charge of the Coven of Witches, as this movie does not shy away from that. And then Madame Blanc is vying for that position. Marcos says some things that keep this position that might not be true. They've also failed with their plot before, and Blanc thinks that there's another route they should go. Now, Susie Banyan complicates things, and I love what happens at the climax. Now, something I really liked about this one is fleshing out Susie's character a lot more. We see that her mother is passing away, but through dreams, this is fleshed out. I love that she was raised as a Mennonite, which those that don't know are very similar to Amish. They are allowed to use machines, but it brings a level of corruption to the more devoutly religious. We also see that there is a perversion to Susie as well. Her coming to the school is embracing it more. We also see that she is talented but raw with her dancing abilities. Blanc sees potential there and wants to cultivate it. Jamie pointed out that there is sexual tension between them, and I think this is an interesting point. Johnson does a great job in this movie, in my opinion. She's another actress who gets a bad rap for not being good in movies that made her famous, in this case, like the 50 Shades of Grey movies. It is something that I saw that she had talent, but it was just hampered by poorly written material in that previous effort. Now, moving to something else I liked was the dance scenes in this film. They're captivating. I saw this with my ex-girlfriend originally, as I said, and I asked her about the dances being done as she was a dancer in college. She stated that for dance that was created in 1940s, it's a bit too modern. It might even be a bit too modern for the 1970s. What I took from this, though, is that being that it is a coven, it has to be more vulgar, and I actually like the idea that it's more of a ritual. I'm not normally into films about dance, but for whatever reason, what they did here was amazing and it sucked me in. So next I'll go over to the pacing of this movie, as this is a long one, and that is something that is important. I do feel that this is a bit lengthy, but we get some things that I don't necessarily think are all that necessarily important, but I don't think this is boring at all. I was drawn in from the beginning and it held my attention throughout. There are some great intercuts of two different things happening at the same exact time that are similar in building to the story or in something happening, and I really like that. This movie flies by, in my opinion, despite its runtime. So going along with the acting, I thought that was amazing. I've already said about how Johnson surprised me at how well she played this role. What I haven't said is that she has such an innocence about her when she arrives, but we see that there has been, you know, sin in her past. She embraces the darkness that is within the academy, and I think a lot of that is wanting to be like Blanc. She wants to be great. Swinton was phenomenal in this film. I thought the portrayal of the three characters that she does were unique and very well done. She's just a talented actress, so I give her a lot of credit. Moretz was solid in the role that she plays, even though it is quite small. I wanted to commend Mia Goth, who is beautiful and great here as well. So I thought the rest of the cast just kind of rounded this film for out what was needed. Shout out to Jessica Harper, who was Susie in the original, and her cameo in this one here. So from there, I'll go over to the effects, which I thought were great as well. This film does something that the original didn't, which is body horror. There was some CGI used there, but I didn't have any issues with it. There are two scenes in particular that really had me cringing, so kudos to the effects team. I do think there are some practical effects in this film as well, which I thought were also good. Now, this is shot beautifully, so I do have to commend them for that as well. It is quite the opposite of the original visually, as that one, you know, has a lot of, you know, colors and things that pop. But instead, this color palette is drab. I like the backdrop of the Berlin Wall, so we're getting a lot of grays. We also get some interesting cinematography where we focus on certain characters while others are talking. The use of mirrors is also interesting. I was just quite impressed with all of this, to be honest. So then finally, I'll go to the soundtrack and sound design. This was something else I thought was good. During the main dance sequence and the climax, I thought it fit beautifully. The movie does seem to have more quiet scenes for a few stretches where I thought that was a, you know, lower key score helped to build suspense. This isn't as iconic as the Goblin score in the original, but to quote my friend Mr. Watson, it is hard to go that route and try to out Argento Dario Argento. So with that said, I took some time before writing this originally to let it process before I wrote this. There was a lot going on in this one, and I thought they added quite a bit to the story. I'm glad this is the route they took. Thought the acting effects and how it was shot were amazing. How they edited certain things together was good to show the duality of different things. Soundtrack fit for what they needed, in my opinion. I think this is a good film and have it just below the original. I'm glad that I am now giving this a second viewing to solidify my feelings. It's not going to be for everybody, but I did enjoy it. So my rating here for Suspiria 2018 is a 9 out of 10 once again. And then I also got to watch The Scary of 61st. This is from 2021. This was co-written and directed by Dasha Nekrasova. Now, she co-wrote this with Madeline Quinn, and then Quinn, Nekrasova, and Betsy Brown starred in this. This is a comedy, horror, mystery, thriller film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 5.3 on IMDb and a 2.6 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being two roommates' lives are upended after finding out that their new Manhattan apartment harbors a dark secret. So this is a movie that I didn't know anything about until I saw a trailer at the Gateway Film Center. I was there with Jamie for a movie that was non-horror. This was before it, and the movie intrigued me. When I saw it playing, I decided to catch the first showing, and I thought the premise looked interesting, and that was about all I knew coming into seeing this one. So where I want to start is that this gets right into it. Part of what excited me about seeing this movie is that it had a short runtime. We get a crash course of learning a bit about our two leads before the movie goes off the rails. Something I should say here is that this could be a detriment to the movie, if I'm going to be honest. There's a lot that is left up to the viewer to piece together and make your own determinations. I do think that's a solid idea sometimes. I just feel this one needed to give us a bit more, but I'll digress there for now. So I want to start delving deeper would be our two leads. I'll start with the character of Addie. What we learn about her is that she seems to be a bit more responsible in the beginning, but that quickly goes away. Anytime she's had issues in the past, she's gone to her father for money as he's rich. Now, her roommate of Noelle thinks that she should when they move into this new place, but Addie is determined to make their own way. We see that she can be clingy and has boundary issues when it comes to her boyfriend of Greg. There is a sequence where she sleepwalks, goes to the door of a building, and masturbates pretty vigorously. We see that from there she might have repressed memories or being possessed. This is part of my issue with the movie is that I think we needed a bit more here. She loses her mind when Greg freaks out on her about something, and from there, we just kind of get some surreal scenes with her. I was a bit annoyed with Brown, who plays this character, at first, but then as things play out, I think her performance is interesting, and I'll give credit to where credit is due. So, next I'll go over to her roommate of Noelle. She is interesting to me as she makes comments that I wasn't expecting in the beginning. She acts like a millennial that you'll see where she doesn't want to really work and wants the easy way out and just kind of coast through life. The more I listen to her, though, the more the movie I think that she's far right, which caught me off guard. I think she might be wearing MAGA socks at one point, which she ends up making an off-base comment before that about those that are less fortunate. And what she thinks about happening to Jeffrey Epstein, as that is a big kind of portion of this movie, is these two women are supposed to be living in an apartment that belonged to him. So when the girl, who is the third character portrayed by Nekrasova, shows up, the two of them spend the rest of the movie together. She mocks the girl for taking speed, but then the two of them go on a drug-fueled rabbit hole to get to the truth of what happened behind this Epstein case. Where she ends up and how the movie shifts was something else I wasn't expecting, especially with a doppelganger character that shows up later. I will give credit there to Quinn and even Nekrasova for the roles that they play. So, since there isn't a lot to the story aside from the case being the crux, I'll go over to the acting. Now, I've already said my piece in the three leads, and I hated them all for different things in the beginning. I don't even like them in the end either. I think that is part of what the movie wants. They aren't doing anything. They think they're changing the world, but they're just playing grown-up. I think the rest of the cast is also fine. Now we have Rappaport, who is the most grounded as Greg. I just don't like his character, and he's really the only person who gets fleshed out of the minor characters, and I think the rest of them just kind of guide our leads to where they end up. So then the last thing I'll go into would be the cinematography effects and the soundtrack. For the former, this movie is shot beautifully. Now I did see a podcaster that I listened to had seen this as well, and they actually saw it in 35mm. I could tell seeing this that there was grain, so it does make sense that this was shot on film. I think that adds an element here. There are some angles that make you think someone is watching our characters, and that adds to the paranoia. The effects we get are limited but look good. They went practical there, which I appreciate. Other than that, the soundtrack fit for what was needed to build the atmosphere as well. There are some creepy things down with the sound design. Credit here to the baby talk that Addie does as well. It was unnerving to me, to be honest. So then, in conclusion here, this movie is well made. I think we have some interesting aspects to it, but there is a bit that is left out for it to, you know, fully come together for me. I think the acting is good, despite me hating every single character in the movie. How this is shot is well done and adds to the atmosphere and the soundtrack, as well as sound design of the movie. There are limited effects, but we also don't need them. I think the story is interesting, and using a real-life thing does date the movie. There just isn't enough fleshed out for me to be fully invested. For what it is, I think this is a solid enough movie. I could recommend this if you want to see the mental state of these three characters break down. This goes out to horror and non-horror fans alike. I just wanted there to be more, to be honest. So that could be a me problem. It might not be for everybody else. And I mean, this is semi, you know, conspiracy theory, politically driven. So keep that in mind coming in as well. So my rating here for The Scary of 61st is going to be a 7 out of 10. And that's all I have for mini reviews for this week. So let me go ahead and get you over to the trailer of my first featured review.
Firstly, I'd like to thank you all for coming here today. For as you are aware, it was a year to the day that Maisie went missing.
I searched for days. I didn't sleep. I didn't stop. I couldn't.
I ain't never making peace with it.
Mom? The stars are moving.
Lights. In the sky. Fast. Non-ballistic.
Morgan's missing, right?
No, he's not missing. He's probably lost in the woods somewhere.
I'm calling.
He's making his way back home right now, okay?
Morgan!
I don't know what I saw. Something's happening. Something unnatural.
Get him!
Something evil.
And for my first featured review on this episode is going to be Dark Encounter. This is from 2019. This was written and directed by Carl Strathe. This stars Laura Frazier, Mel Rado, and Sid Phoenix, while also featuring Grant Masters, Spike White, Alice Lowell, Nicholas Pinnock, Vincent Regan, Bridget Daughtry, Sean Knopp, Kate Coogan, Charlotte Kilby, Simon Bond, Sarah Winter, Anne Whitman, Lucy, Alexandra Bosted, and Graham Bronwell. This is a mystery sci-fi thriller film that I also consider to be horror, and this is from the United Kingdom. It is currently sitting on a 5.3 on IMDb and a 2.6 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being 8-year-old Maisie went missing in 1982, and a memorial is held by her family a year later. That evening, strange lights and sounds are observed in the woods outside, and strange things start to happen. So this was a movie that I got turned on to thanks to podcasts. It went on a list of movies to check out, and during January, I like to do this segment here where I assign all the movies on a list a number and let a number randomizer decide what I watch. And this is the one that popped up, so that is why I am covering it here. So before I get to the movie itself, let me do some notes on the key players, and I'll start with the director of Strathe. He has two credits. It looks like he enjoys doing stuff with space and movies and stuff like that, because he has two of them, are the only two he's done, and the other movie he's done is Solus, which I've heard of but I have not seen. That one isn't horror, but similar science fiction feels, I was saying. So this is the only movie from him that I have seen. And then as a writer, it's pretty much the same for this guy as well. So then to the actors, first I'll start with Frasier. She has 48 credits. Of them, I've seen 4. It appears that most of them are outside the genre that I have seen with like The Man in the Iron Mask and A Knight's Tale. She has 4 in genre. Her first was from 1995 with Good Day for the Bad Guys, which I have not seen or heard of. Now, I have seen 2 of her movies, and it's actually one that I'm probably going to be watching. At the time of recording, I haven't seen it yet, but I probably will for this episode, so, you know, kind of going into the past here, as I Am Not a Serial Killer, and then this is the only other one that I've seen aside from that. Then her co-star of Rado has 17 credits. Of them, I've only seen this movie here. He does have 3 total in horror. First was Long Time Dead from 2002. Now, he followed it by something called The Disappointments Room. And then this movie here, I have not heard of his first 2, to be honest. Now, there's Phoenix. He has 8 credits. This is the only horror film and the only one that I've seen from him. Now, I also wanted to look at a 4th person here of Alice Lowell. She has 49 credits. I've seen 6 of them. Outside of horror, but still adjacent, are movies like Hot Fuzz and The World's End. Her first in genre was 2010 with Brethren. I have seen her in Kill List, Sightseers, Prevenge, and now this movie here. And I do end up enjoying her acting quite a bit, so I just kind of want to, you know, put that out there as well. So for this movie here, we start off with seeing the stars above Woods. There is an odd light coming from them as well. Then the movie shifts us to a house. We see a picture frame that is broken, and the water in the sink in the kitchen is running. A couple then comes home. Now, they are married, and it's Olivia, portrayed by Frasier, and Ray Anderson, portrayed by Rado. The front door is open, and they call out to their daughter of Maisie. They soon learn that she isn't there, and panic sets in, and a search for her commences. Now, the movie then takes us 1 year into the future. Maisie's brother is putting up new flyers, stating that she is still lost, and they're still looking for her. Now, his name is Noah. He's portrayed by White. We shift back to the house as a group arrives back after a memorial for this little girl. We have Olivia, Ray, and their son of Noah are among them. There's also Ray's brother of Billy, portrayed by Phoenix, and Morgan, portrayed by Reagan. We have Olivia's sister is also there, Arlene, portrayed by Lowell, and her husband, who is the deputy in the area, of Kenneth Burroughs, portrayed by Masters. Things aren't good in the household. Ray is short with Noah and even Billy. He's also sleeping on the couch. Maisie's disappearance can still be felt by this family, even after a year. Things all take a turn that night. Ray goes out onto the porch and experiences something odd. There are lights in the woods and something flies overhead. He doesn't understand what it is and thinks that some local boys are messing around. He decides to go out there and put an end to it. The men inside don't think it's a good idea, though. It is decided that Billy, Noah, Morgan, and Kenneth are all going to come with him to, you know, have words with these kids. They arrive in the woods and experience something they cannot explain. The rest of the family at the house also have an experience of their own. It makes Noah wonder if what is behind this could explain what happened to his missing sister. And this night becomes a nightmare none of these people are ever going to forget. So that's where I'm going to leave my recap for this movie. Now, I knew coming in that this was dealing with aliens. That could be a spoiler, but it is something that gets introduced really early into this movie. I'll be honest, this subgenre of movies is one that interests me. Personally, I don't think that aliens have come to the Earth like this. I know the government in the beginning of the pandemic revealed that there is documented proof that extraterrestrial life has come to Earth. The thought of being abducted is a terrifying one, and that's what kind of gets me unnerved. There aren't a lot of great movies that deal with it, especially in the horror genre, so I'm intrigued to check out movies that feature it to try to see if I can fill that void. Now, to delve deeper into this, it is strategic to have this take place in the early 1980s. It isn't too in your face with it, though. There is a television, a record player, and the house the movie takes place in looks like it is dated with its furnishings. I'm guessing part of the reason for it is being set during this time period is to not have cell phones. With a lot of movies and television shows putting their, you know, show back in these periods, I'm give credit to that this one does work. Now, I want to circle back to the crux of this movie with this family dealing with aliens. It starts by splitting them up and having them in the woods, as well as some of them staying back. I thought what we see is good. There is a lot being done with lights and people going into trances. We also have people disappearing and those that are still here trying to figure out what is happening. It is also affecting the people in the house, as I said. everyone that is still around converge back there, and the attack continues. The atmosphere it establishes for this is good. I thought it was creepy, and it kept my attention to wonder what would happen next. And I even like that we see that this is not just isolated to them, that it's actually a much bigger thing happening with the area as well. So the last thing for the story I want to go into would be that I don't love the resolution of this movie. I'm glad that we get an answer to what happened to Maisie. It is interesting what the reveal for this is, though. I will give credit that it is something that is a bit different, to be honest. I do like the idea that humanity could be worse than this threat that is not of this world. It is something we see quite often, though. Despite not loving it, it does work for what the aliens' plan was here. They might not be necessarily the villains that we think they are. So I think I should be enough here, so I will now go to the acting. I was shocked to see that this stars Frasier. She isn't a big actress, but she is someone that I've seen in a handful of things, like I said earlier. I thought she was good as our mother here. Another one was Lowell. Now, she is a British actor, so seeing her in this was different, and then it actually makes a whole lot of sense that this caused me while I was writing my review to look into this, and this is from the UK, and that also makes sense why Frasier is here. Her accent, though, of Lowell's was a bit too thick, though, to come off as someone who is from the hills of Pennsylvania. I did have an issue with Rado as well. He comes off wooden at times, especially when he's trying to convey emotions. Aside from that, though, I thought like Phoenix, Masters, White, and Reagan were all solid as the rest of the family. I did like Pinnock as Sheriff Reese Jordan and Daughtry in her minor role as Maisie. The acting is still decent enough, though, despite my little issues that I had there. So then, next let me go into the effects, cinematography, and soundtrack. For the former, I'd say that the practical ones we get are limited, but they are fine. There is some CGI here that can be a bit hit or miss. There were some things with birds and like seeing an alien. There were some slight issues that I have there, but nothing that actually ruins this movie. Thought the cinematography was good. I will give credit there as we get some angles that they're using mirrors that I liked. And then there are some beautiful establishing shots as well. Other than that, I thought the soundtrack was solid enough. The sound design does help with the atmosphere and make some scenes creepier as well. Now, I did have a little bit of trivia that I wanted to share from the IMDb page. Although the movie establishes that the events happen in Blue Hill County, Pennsylvania, actually the movie was filmed in North Yorkshire, England. In real life, Blue Hill is a summit close to Susquehanna River in North Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, having 17821 as a zip code delivery area. The film gives quite a few nods to various scenes in Close Encounters of the Third Kind from 1977, which I've actually never seen. Like a car on the road at night with stars moving in the sky behind the car, a van turning on and turning off by itself, strange noises in the telephone, a house taken by strange light, a toy monkey with symbols, a toy train, someone looking inside of a chimney draft. This movie also has nods to Signs from 2002, Static on TV, a swing moving alone, a family trapped in their house besieged by aliens, and a family broke after a personal loss. The rifle carried by the lead character is a German K98 with scope. Sometimes it appears with a hooded sight. Sometimes the sight is uncovered. So then in conclusion here, this is a solid movie. I came in having an idea of what this movie was about, but I'll be honest, it goes in a direction I wasn't necessarily expecting. We have a depressing concept that is made worse. What they do in the end isn't my favorite direction, but I will still give it credit. The acting has some hiccups. It is solid enough to bring these characters to life, though. Much of the same for the effects. The practical ones are good, while there are some minor issues with CGI. Soundtrack is fine, and the sound design does add to the atmosphere. For me, I'd say this is an above-average movie. This is one that I'd say if you're into the concept, give this one a go. This would be for horror and non-horror fans alike, in my opinion, as well. So my rating here for Dark Encounter is going to be a 7 out of 10. Now, I'm not going to do a spoiler section, so let me go ahead and get you over to the trailer of my second featured review.
Now, Yasmin, I need to talk about the will. You're going to get everything. Everything in the house is yours. The books are the most valuable thing, and all the movie rights and the royalties that go with it, you get all that. But let me tell you about my most recent project. Oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be big. So big, it's going to be the biggest thing I've ever done. I bought a 17th century book on black magic. And in that book, they teach you how to cast magical spells by writing stories about them. And when you read these stories aloud, they come to life. Ow! Oh, you bitch! You know what I told you? I love your almond sugar cookies.
Yeah?
I lied. This shit tastes like camel spit. Ow! Ah! be much bigger than anything that you see 3D, men in tights hanging from walls somewhere. No, this is going to be so much bigger. Because when you read these stories out loud, they come to life. You can have a real vampire in your own kitchen. Now, if you do this, remember, you don't...
Oh my God, he's gone crazy.
And for my second feature review on this episode is going to be Monsters in the Closet. This is from here in 2022. This is directed by the Snig Brothers. I think that's how you would say that. And they also helped write this along with Jasmine Flores, Luke Cozens, and Carmilla Crawford. This stars Jasmine Flores, Tom Chiskowski, and Cozens as well. And then this is also featuring Shauna Bess, Valerie Bittner, John Paul Fedeli, Jordan Flippo, Flores, Denise Hollis, Francis James, and Sarah Maribel. This is a horror thriller film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 3.9 on IMDb and I would say around a 2-star film on Letterboxd. With its synopsis being a horror author's stories come to life when read aloud. So this is a movie that I sought out since it was the first 2022 horror film that I could find. I saw this was an anthology, so that piqued my interest. And I do have to give credit here to my friend on social media of Don, as I saw he reviewed this on Letterboxd, so I knew there was at least one movie out from this year that I could do here for the podcast, as well as to keep up, you know, my pace of what I like to try to do every year for new watches. So then before I get into the movie itself, let me do some notes on some of the key people here, and I'll start off with our directors here of the Snig Brothers. From what I can see, this is their feature film debut. Now, I'm not getting any information as to the writers at this time on Letterboxd, so then I'll move over to the actors, and I'll start with Chiskowski. He has 3 credits. 2 are in the genre with Bacterium as his first from 2006, and this is the only movie that I've seen him in here. And then this is looks to be Flores' feature film debut. And then we also have Cozens, and it looks like he has 3 shorts to his credit, along with his feature film debut back in 2011 of Chimera. Now, it only looks like there's 10 people who have rated it according to IMDb. It doesn't have what genre that movie is in, so needless to say, I've never heard of it, and this is the only one that I've seen him in as well. So then, to get into this movie here, we start with our wraparound story where we have Raymond Castle portrayed by Chiskowski. Now, he's a writer from the synopsis, and he's in a panic trying to finish what he's doing as there is a killer that is coming for him. Now, he can't finish in time and is killed. This brings his daughter of Jasmine, portrayed by Flores, home. Their relationship was contentious, and she isn't thrilled. Now, on her way to the house, she runs into an Alexandria, portrayed by Karen Zhang. She wants the rights to Raymond's newest book, but Jasmine isn't ready to deal with this yet. Now, when she arrives at the house, she logs into her father's computer and finds a file directed towards her. From it, she learns that her father found a book on black magic, and if you write the stories, then read them aloud, they come to life. Jasmine stops listening to the video and decides to open the file of her father reading his newest stories. Now, from here, we get these 4 shorts. The first one is following Jenny, portrayed by Hollis, who has become a zombie. We are hearing her inner thoughts, voiced by Kim Carson and Sierra Neves, as she figures out what happened in her new existence. It takes her some time to come to terms with it as well. Then our second story is following a young couple of Zeke, portrayed by Cozens, and Tina, portrayed by Crawford, as they bought a fixer-upper house. They didn't fully understand what they were getting themselves into, and now their house broke, and the stress of what they're doing weighs on them. Then our third story here is a new high school graduate of Tiffany Collins, portrayed by Flippo. Now, she wants to go camping with her friends and her new boyfriend of Vinny, portrayed by Nelson Joaquin, but she is seeking the approval of her father. His name is Chester, portrayed by Philip Green, and he is a rich man. He points out to her that they're part of the 1%, and she's going to Princeton. She does convince him, but we see that Tiffany might have some issues when the trip turns deadly. Then the final story is a comedic take on the Frankenstein story, but in New Jersey. We have Dr. Frankenstein, portrayed by Fedeli, and he is married to Mrs. Frankenstein, portrayed by Bittner, who is an aging former beauty queen. When she accidentally dies on her birthday, Dr. Frankenstein goes about bringing her back to life. He doesn't have the success that he was wanting, and it is much more difficult to return her to how she was. So that's where I'm going to leave my recap of the movie itself, and where I'll start is at the structure of this movie. This is taking on a, you know, classic version of an anthology, and I do appreciate that. The wraparound we get makes sense. The premise as well is one that isn't necessarily original, but I won't hold that against it. There is a book on black magic that was used. Immediately I go to the Necronomicon. Seeing that Jasmine finds in the basement, it feels almost more like voodoo, as there's a doll down there, there is a hat that looks like it might belong to Baron Samedi, and we also have a Ouija board. The premise of using this book and reading the stories to make them come to life is fine. It's interesting that the movie is alluding to all of that with the posters in Raymond's house. Now, these are supposed to be the movies that he got famous for. I recognize some of them as just low-budget movies, and I, you know, actually know some of these movies. I haven't seen any of them but one. I think I saw a Bite Me poster in the background, but that was it. But I did see, like, a Call Girl of Cthulhu poster up there. I've never seen that, but I do know of it. Now, as the stories themselves, I think we have some good ideas here. The one on zombies is interesting. We are seeing someone as they change and hearing their thoughts. They are still human, but the body is doing other things than what the brain is telling it to. I thought this was creative. The home improvement one is one that hits home. I love the idea of this young couple buying a house and getting in over their head, as it fits the times. The same goes for the one percenters. My issue with that one is it doesn't really seem to have a resolution. I like the bleakness that we get with how things play out, but it wasn't handled all that well in my opinion. And the last one was my least favorite. It just felt rushed, and I might be jaded as I've seen a lot of Frankenstein adaptations, so I expected a bit more. So then, something else I want to go into for the story is I understand the concept of what is happening with the reading the stories, but I don't think the wraparound with them coming to life works. I think the zombie story should have been moved, as that gets Jasmine moving. The number of zombies it brings after her makes it more difficult to survive. The problem, though, is that that is one of the better shorts, so they have to lead off with a stronger one. What comes to life from the other stories just feels odd to me, and I don't know if I thought it was as well as they wanted to, and I almost feel like you need to have people from those actual shorts be the thing coming to life, and that's not necessarily what we get in the movie. So it almost makes me wonder if these shorts were made for the movie, or if they were just made and then somebody decided to, you know, kind of mesh everything together. So then I'm going to move away from the story and go to the acting. I wasn't impressed with anybody, to be honest. Cousins and Crawford are solid enough as this young couple. I like the progression of them being over the top in love to where they end up. I will give credit here for them. Chakotsky is wooden in how he acts. Flores was fine, but we don't get much there either. Fedeli and Bittner work well off each other, but their story just didn't hook me. Filippo was attractive, and I think she fits her character well. I just say overall that the acting is just subpar. It does feel like we have a lot of younger actors without a lot of experience here as well. So that'll take me over then to the effect cinematography and the soundtrack. For the former, we get some good practical ones here and there. I like the zombie makeup and how they moved. The movie does go heavy with CGI and it isn't very good. It looks cheap and there's just a lack of blood, and what I'm seeing just kind of took me out of the movie. I take this then is how it was shot as well, and I thought it was good at times. The POV of the zombie was interesting. Seeing the progression in Home Improvement was fine. From there, I'd say that the rest of this was shot okay. It didn't stand out though either. Then as for the soundtrack, the best one was The Last Story. I love the use of classical music they have. None of the other shorts kind of stood out with their music. The inner thoughts of Jenny was interesting, so I will give credit to that. So then in conclusion here, I thought there were some good ideas for the stories, but the execution was just lacking for me. The wraparound in the first three I thought have something there, but the last one was just a weak attempt at Frankenstein. I don't like the trash movies, so let me preface that before going on. The acting I thought was subpar. The limited practical effects are fine, but the CGI is bad. The soundtrack for the Frankenstein story is the best, with the rest of them just, you know, not necessarily standing out. We get some good cinematography early and the rest is okay. Taking the average of all the stories, I have this as a below average anthology. I can't recommend this, but there are some people out there who enjoy lower budget movies like this. I think you can get some enjoyment out of something like that for sure. So my rating here for Monsters in the Closet is going to be a 4 out of 10. Now, there wasn't any trivia that I could find on the IMDb page or anything like that, and I'm not going to do a spoiler section, so let me go ahead and get you over to a very brief break before I close out this show. I would like to welcome you back one last time, and then just to close everything out here for this episode, if you'd like to send me an email with anything that you'd like to have read on the show or any sort of feedback, you could send me an email at journeywithacinephile@gmail.com. If you'd like to read any of the reviews for anything on this episode or any of the past episodes, that's Reviews of the Dead, and that's horrorreview.webnode.com. If you'd like to become friends with me on Facebook, it's David Michigan Garrett Jr. On Twitter, I'm Buckeye from Mish. Letterboxd, I'm David OSU. And over there, I'll be posting all of my reviews that are horror and non-horror alike. If you'd like to follow my Instagram page, it's DavidOSU87. And the Journey with a Cinephile Instagram page is Journey with a Cinephile, all one word. And over on both of those, I'll be posting all of the movie posters of anything that I am reviewing. And then, you know, my personal one, I will every now and then have some things from my personal life on there. Not very often, just because I don't really get Instagram all that much. So I will have all those links in the show notes just to make it easier on you. And then the last thing I'd ask you to do is that whatever podcatching device you're listening to me on, if you could go ahead and hit subscribe so you never miss a new episode, that would be greatly appreciated. As well as you're able to rate and review just so I can figure out what I'm doing that you like and what I'm doing that you don't like, as well as to get to more listeners out there as well. So for my next episode is going to be another one of these New Year, New Movie episodes, as I didn't think I could find a 2022 release, so I end up going to the randomizer and end up pulling Doom Asylum. Well, I end up figuring out before I, you know, finish watching that as well as recording all of this, that there is a 2022 movie that is out that I, you know, have watched. Obviously, you could tell on this episode here. So Doom Asylum is going to be the movie that popped up there. I'm assuming now that we are about a week and a half at recording this into the new year that I should be able to find another 2022 film. So that will be the other one. Not sure what it's going to be as of yet. And then for my Trek to the Twos, I am actually going to be watching a movie that I've seen before, and Vampyr. That will be the movie from 1932, since the only other ones for 1922 I have not seen as of yet. So I'll come back to those when I start doing my Centennial Club episodes. So I think that should be enough to get you up to speed with here for this one. So what I will say then in closing is that whatever you do today, I hope you're safe and doing it and have a great time out there. This is your tour guide of David Garrett Jr., and I am signing off.
It had been a wonderful evening, and what I needed now to give it the perfect ending.